Welcome, my friends. It is Easter on this fifth day of April, 2015, and we have a special transmission for you today. I guess in radio parlance, they would call it a best of, but some of it will be original with some of the new special reports that have been filed at InfoWars Nightly News, like the ones you're about to hear here in just a moment, and then the amazing interview a few weeks ago with a former technical director of the National Security Agency, William Binney. Then we have Barrett Brown, the political prisoner, is going to be joining us from prison. That interview with David Knight and Paul Joseph Watson, very important. And then that ties in to Bruce Fein, the former head lawyer for the FCC, who helped end fairness doctrine. He weighs in on the persecution of journalists and the media and the FCC power grab. Daniel Estulin on the latest on Bilderberg. We're going to talk to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, recently exonerated with the proof of his studies and what vaccines are doing to children, and more. All this in the next 2 hours. But now, this excerpt from InfoWars Nightly News, then we'll be back after the break.
Yesterday, we brought you the news about a mass shooting, a campus shooting in Kenya. The terrorist group Al-Shabaab opened fire at Garissa University College and killed nearly 150 people. Fox News reported the men were going door to door asking people their religion, and if they answered they were a Christian, they shot them on the spot. The first responders engaged the terrorists but were flat out outgunned. Al-Shabaab is the same group that attacked a mall in Nairobi years ago, killing many innocent people. And now they're threatening attacks here on U.S. soil, threatening the Mall of America. DHS has investigated the group and found them to be no credible threat. And I hope they're right. But if they're wrong, I'm very happy that we live in a country where we have concealed carriers.
He kept pulling the charging handle and hitting the side.
The break in gunfire allowed Mealy to pull out his own gun.
I saw someone in the back of the Charlotte move. And I knew that if I fired and missed, I could end up hitting them.
So Mealy took cover inside a nearby store.
I'm not beating myself up because I didn't shoot him. But I know that after he saw me, I think the last shot he fired was the one that he used on himself.
The gunman was dead.
And in the Clackamas shooting, the mere sight of armed opposition forced the gunman to turn the gun upon himself. I guess he didn't want to take the chance of being taken alive. And now we're all asking the same question. How do we combat these mass shootings? Well, the chief of Interpol has come out and said, well, maybe we should just arm the citizens. The people should be able to protect themselves. And I do agree. Now, am I trying to put a firearm in every dorm room in America? No. But if you're somebody of age, of sound mind and body, and you don't have any criminal proceedings, you know, I think you should be able to go out and purchase a gun to keep yourself safe. But not everybody agrees with this point of view. And there are now actually articles out debunking the effectiveness of armed citizens. I have some self-defense stories here, and for the purposes of this report, I restricted this to public people in public places and not private individuals in their homes. We'll start with this one. Back in 2012, two robbers enter an internet cafe, one's holding a bat, the other one has a pistol. He jumps up with his own pistol, shoots at the robbers, and chases them out like the rats that they are. You see, guys scurry and pretty pathetic. But he saved the day. Another story from Wisconsin. A gentleman pulls out his concealed carry and then shoots this guy once the coast is clear. Gas station clerk thwarted robbery, fired for violating company's no weapons policy. So this guy, he saved himself and the people in the store, but he lost his job, unfortunately. Another story out of Philadelphia, a barbershop patron shoots a gunman dead. Armed robber, no match for pharmacist with a 45. And there are videos accompanying most of these articles I'm showing you. We're just skipping them for the sake of time, but you're welcome to go back and look at them for yourself. Woman fends off would-be attackers with concealed gun. And this is a bank employee with a concealed carry shoots would-be robber in the jaw. Another bank story. Bank customer thwarts robbery after returning to car to grab gun. And we'll end with this one. India's first gun for women fares well among men. And this was in response to the Delhi gang rape of 2012, where the young lady was raped on the bus with an iron rod by several attackers. And now they have a gun specifically designed for the women. I think the gun is way overpriced, but I'm happy to see that the young ladies are carrying this nonetheless and are able to defend themselves. Keep this in mind as we go forward, and hopefully we diminish these gun-free zones and get rid of these soft targets. You can find more reports on InfoWars.com.
You're listening to The Alex Jones Show. We'll be right back on the other side with the NSA whistleblower.
Defending the Republic from enemies, foreign and domestic. It's Alex Jones.
Thank you for joining us on this Easter broadcast. I want to go to our annals here, or our archives for a moment. Not too far back, a few weeks ago, we had the former technical director of the National Security Agency, a huge whistleblower, on the broadcast, and he dropped bombshell after bombshell while he was on. So here are some of those tidbits of information. Mr. Benny is a real hero. He'll just say he did his duty. But in a world of traitors, someone doing their duty is heroic. And he joins us here today. William, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know where to start. We could recap your story, what's happening, get into the exciting stuff about you coming back from Germany. You've been talking to parliaments over there. You've been talking to the EU people, the British Parliament, big national headlines where you say it's a totalitarian takeover in The Guardian. But here it's starting to come out in the news as well. I guess they failed to silence you. We could talk about you working with Oliver Stone now on the new Snowden documentary. We could get into the slides and break down the fact that it is going on from an expert, showing us not what's classified, but what's already been leaked so you don't get in trouble. We're here with the former technical director of the NSA, the guy that actually ran it, William Benny. So you've got the floor, sir.
Yeah, there's so much here. It's really hard to know where to start because it's really been our government has moved into basically sliding down the totalitarian slope. Taking massive amounts of data on our citizens and then working around and doing it across the world. So it's basically they're doing this for everybody in the planet. And the process started here in the NSA, and it has started to spread around the world to the Five Eyes countries, US, the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and then to other countries like in Germany and Switzerland and Sweden and Israel. So the process of data collection, and now the Russians are doing it. I just read an article where they're starting this kind of operation. So now the Russians are following our lead in this spying business.
It's a big brother race.
Right. When I first started in October 2001, it was very clear to me that this was a process that we were adopting in the United States that was really a Soviet attempt or a Stasi attempt in East Germany to assemble all the information on U.S. on their populations. Why? It's because they wanted to control their populations. That was the whole point of the totalitarian states. It has been down through history. I mean, this is nothing new. This has been repeated so many times in Caesar Augustus. You know, it was so clear right up front. But, I mean, you can ask anybody in the Tea Party who's been denied access to 501c3. You can look at the IRS use of the data. Look at the law enforcement,
FBI. DEA with a DEA, parallel construction.
The parallel construction. I mean, that's spread around the world to other police organizations around the world, too. Anybody with an organization or police organization that has a relationship with the FBI or the DEA around the world is subject to getting this kind of information, but they'll never be given the original data from the NSA collection because it's not admissible in a court of law because it wasn't acquired by a warrant. And they don't want to, with foreigners, compromise the fact that they have the ability to collect them.
And don't they then fence it and wash it, and they've been caught adding disinformation, and it's a perfect way to put into the global data stream frame-ups?
They did that kind of framing with us. They did that even with us. The Department of Justice did that. They framed us. They attempted to. But
Speak a little bit about that. I think that gives people a window into how totalitarian this is.
Well, for example, in the case the only case that went to court was Tom Drake's case, they took him to court because he was still working for NSA at the time. This was in 2007 when they raided us initially, and then they raided Tom Drake about 3 months later. His case didn't get to court till about 2010. Well, 2010 they charged him, and 2011, 10 and 11 in that frame, they wanted to take him to court. What they did was they took information that he had at his house that was marked unclassified, and they changed that. They drew a line through that and then stamped it classified, secret or top secret, then charged him with having classified material. That's like retroactively classifying something so you can charge somebody with having classified material. That's framing him, okay?
It's a forgery, it's a fraud, it's a major felony.
Right. And the problem with it is that they didn't know what they had done. They'd released most of that material themselves, NSA did, into the public domain, unclassified. And that's what Jim Bamford found.
Because Drake wasn't stupid. He didn't want to go to prison. He was only bringing out what was already out there.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it was unclassified by NSA regulations. That was the way they stamped it. So
I had the former director of Star Wars on. He died a few years ago, Dr. Bob Bowman. And he talked about some of the space planes once. And then they called him and came to his house and, you know, kind of threatened him. And he said, hey, here's where it was released on C-SPAN. And here's where you guys in your own propaganda a decade ago released it. And then they couldn't go after him. But that's the type of stuff they pull.
Right. It's a total fabrication of evidence to put people in jail. That's our Department of Justice doing it.
The Bible calls it bearing false witness.
Yes. I call it perjury and a felony. And these people should be charged and given a chance to explain what they did and why they
did it. Tell folks what happened to you before we get into the NSA itself.
For me, in my case, I was kind of prominent, you know, complaining to senators and representatives and various other people, as was Tom Drake.
Let's be clear. You guys were doing this internally.
We were internal of the government, yes. We were going to the inspector. Kirk Wiebe and I even went to talk to the Department of Justice Inspector General. And of course, they couldn't say anything to us, but we made it clear what the problem was with this domestic spying. But for me and all four of us, we were the four who were first raided in July of 2007. We were raided because we were the ones who signed the DODIG complaint against NSA, charging them with corruption, fraud, waste, and abuse. And that caused a major DOD investigation of NSA that all verified what we were saying, and that was published but redacted because it was even the unclassified, embarrassing parts were redacted. Which is a violation of the NSA, the government.
Open records.
Yeah, well, it's a violation of government classification regulations, too. In other words, Executive Order 13526, Section 1.7 says you can't classify something or keep it classified or not declassified if it's evidence of a crime or evidence of that embarrasses an agency or
you can't use the National Security Act to cover up criminal activity.
Exactly. And that's basically what the NSA and the DOJ and the DOD with that investigative report, that's what they were doing. They were redacting it and hiding it from Congress and hiding it from everybody else. So they're covering up what they're doing. And for us, they attempted after the raid, by the way, the DODIG's office was the one that gave our names as the ones who submitted that complaint against NSA. They gave our names to the FBI.
Wow.
And that was against their regulations, okay? I mean, who knows?
So they're all breaking the law while accusing you of doing it.
Yes.
And all you're doing is going to congressional committees and inspector generals whose job it is to have oversight and telling them, hey, they're breaking the law.
Yes. And also, it's the committees who are supposed to, the intelligence committees in the House and Senate and also the FISA court were established after the Church Committee investigation of NSA, CIA, and FBI in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And one of the main persons they were spying on back in the Minaret program was Senator Church.
That's right.
That was only came out recently. And the reason they didn't, of course, was because they are spying on people who have power over them.
And let's be clear, because the fake conservative argument and the fake liberal argument is the same. We're protecting you from Al-Qaeda and drug dealers and all this other stuff. But then as more of this gets leaked and comes out, they're spying on Parliament, they're spying on Congress, they're spying on other agencies, and there's so much spying going on, and you've explained this, that back when you were really spying on the Russians, really spying on radical Islamists, legally and lawfully, that was already legal and lawful. It's the domestic stuff that's illegal, but they confuse people and say, let us protect you from Al-Qaeda, when actually they're doing the opposite. They're letting all these groups operate because they're too busy spying on their boyfriends and their girlfriends and the congressmen.
Yeah, that's one of the cases that came out was what they called an NSA love intelligence. That's where the analysts were looking into the data to see whether or not their better parts or their spouses or girlfriends were cheating on them. Well, you don't do that. First of all, you don't do that, America. You do not do that with metadata. You do that with content. And that's what they've been trying to hide, that they've been collecting content all along. Since 2002, at least.
If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance. You're listening to The Alex Jones Show.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen, on this Easter transmission. Let's get right back to this important interview with William Binney, formerly of the National Security Agency. William Binney, the former director of the technical division of the NSA. I've seen the news say you were the number two, number three, number four. What position were you in the NSA? What that position, what level is that?
Well, I was a senior executive grade. If you get in military ranks, that'd be like a 1.5 star general. So, but I was the technical director of the World Geopolitical Military Analysis and Reporting Shop. That was about 6,000 analysts and reporters.
How high is your IQ? Because they say you've got like a mathematical brain. Come on, be serious. Was it about 180?
No. I think it was 143 or something like that. But, you know, I'm just a basic country boy, fundamentally.
But you've got a genius for numbers and code cracking.
I had a real bent for that, doing that, yes. It's just a talent that you have to be able to look at patterns and see patterns in data. And when you can do that, that's the kind of thing you need to be able to break things and solve problems.
Somehow I want to have you on just about you, because I mean, I know most of it's classified, but I mean, you battled the Russians, the Chinese, everybody, right?
Mostly Warsaw Pact, European communist countries, and the Soviet Union.
And you said before it upset you to go from really going spying after serious folks to like spying on congressmen.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and every U.S. citizen in the country. Yeah. No one was exempt. I mean, everybody was taken in. I mean, even Senator Rockefeller, when he was addressed in January on CNN, I think it was, he addressed it. He said they've got data on, they probably even got data on me. Well, I mean, what he's saying was right. I mean, they're collecting all the data content and metadata on everybody in the
country.
Explain
those lies for folks. They claim, oh, it's just metadata, just, you know, basically when you called, when you didn't call, like a phone bill. No. Explain what they're really doing.
Well, Mark Klein kind of exposed that too, and it's in court record in Mark Klein's case, where he laid out the wiring for all the NSA room in the AT&T facility in San Francisco.
Sure.
And on that, I think it was room 641B. What they did was they put a prism type affair or a splitter, what's called a splitter or Y connector, where you have a fiber coming in and it duplicates it and sends it down two paths. One path went to the NSA room, and the other path went to a normal distribution of communications. In the NSA room, all the diagramming showed all the NARIS devices they had in there, where they pushed the fiber optic networks into the NARIS device. What that did was recompile everything on the line and sessionize it, meaning reassemble all the data. Like if you send an email, it goes out in packets. We'll pull all those packets back together and say, here's the email you just sent. And then they would pass that on to NSA for storage. And that's what that device did. It did content collection, not just metadata, but the content.
And then now we know those hubs are everywhere. And in front of us, they're building giant, huge complexes to store it all.
Yes. The latest one that they've just submitted an environmental impact statement for is a 2.8 million square foot facility on Fort Meade, taking up basically the golf course at Fort Meade.
2.8 million.
It's about three times the size of Bluffdale. Just about three times. That's a million square feet. This is 2.8.
What I love about the NSA, we've had reporters in San Antonio and in Utah, and you just get there at the Walmart parking lot and start videotaping. They run up. The police go, how dare you videotape us? It's just a public, it's publicly known. It's there. Meanwhile, they're stealing all of our data, but, you can't aim a camera at us.
Yeah, right. They're hypocritical about this. I mean, they're all hypocrites. I mean, they're violating the Constitution. They say they're not everything that's legal. Well, that's retroactively passing laws. The problem with that is the laws that they pass have to abide to the Constitution. And when you violate the Fourth Amendment, it doesn't matter what kind of law you pass that says it's okay to do that. It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, and it's not constitutional.
And they've said, the Constitution's dead. You ignore it. It won't be a problem. But now we see the president saying, I'm going to open the borders without even an order. Not even Congress. Not even an order from Obama. I'm going to come after your guns without an order or without a law. They don't even do the fake orders now. They just do it. Obama announced yesterday, no more FOIAs for the White House. We're just not going to follow the law. I mean, this is dictatorship, not of Obama himself, but of the system, in my view. How would you describe this slide?
It's a slide into totalitarianism and an imperial presidency and a control of population process. I mean, that's what they're doing. I mean, they kept everybody in the dark, so you had no informed electorate to make a decision about who to vote for, about these issues, or even raising these issues. They're all avoiding this issue. And they have an uninformed Congress, because that's why Representatives Amash and Conyers got a group together, a coalition of Republicans and Democrats, to try to unfund NSA, because they realized that they were being lied to by the agencies, by the intelligence committees, and by the administration about what was going on. So, I mean, they had an uninformed Congress and an uninformed electorate by design. And that's basically what the Soviet Union, the sure. Germans, that's basically what they did.
I got a lot of questions coming up for you, William Benning. I want you to be able to speak on other topics you want to get into and go through some slides you gave us that Snowden leaked, so you can break this down for people to kind of give us a roadmap of what's going on. But my big question is, as best you know, not being there in 15 years, but what's leaked and what people have said, how many people really have access to the big master files to go in and send a order in and then get all my emails from a year ago, or go and see a text file of a phone call I had last night? How many people have access to this? Because if Snowden could really get access to all of this, that means governments and spies could as well. So even if we had good people in government, which we know at the top we don't, they built this fraud, they've built something that could be taken over or hacked and thus compromise everything. You build something that spies on everything, you've just built something that corporations, spies, private corporate criminals, anybody can get into and exploit and sell. And with government's history of selling driver's license, selling uranium, whatever the case is, this looks like it's a giant bazaar of information that they've just opened up.
Yes, and internally in NSA, they have no monitoring of the network as to what's going on and who's using it. My estimate in terms of, I mean, some of the numbers I've seen say that...
Let's stop there. I don't mean to interrupt you. We monitor our network to see what people are doing around here. We monitor to see if they're downloading stuff that's illegal. We have to, liability. The NSA doesn't monitor their own network.
That's right. In fact, we had proposed in the SARC, the Signal Automation Research Center, we'd proposed a program we called Well Grounded that said we wanted to monitor the entire worldwide network of NSA, who was on it, when they were on it, what they were doing when they were there as they did it. And it would be a matter of monitoring the network log, like you probably do here. The same principle. It's the idea where anybody on the network sends data down the line, you can see what they're doing, and it's recorded in the log. So you can analyze that log with software, and that's what we intended and proposed to do. We had two groups opposing that. One were all the analysts saying, you will be able to see everything I'm doing. I don't want you monitoring. Okay?
But they're working in a secret government operation. Yeah. They're the ones that should have a record.
Exactly.
Plus, that people could just sell their code and let anybody in.
Yeah.
Oh, my. I mean, if I was a spy running America, I would want there to be no monitoring.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the part. That's exactly what the analysts said. But the real opposers of it were the managers. And the reason they didn't want that happening was we could watch the movement of all the money. We could see all the money being spent on every program, the return on investment of every program, whether or not they were successful or not, what companies were competing for it, all of that kind
of thing. So they didn't want any oversight. So basically, it's a giant looting operation.
Exactly. In fact, there is no oversight. There's no auditing of NSA by Congress. Congress does not audit NSA. This is a setup for corruption.
You can complain about Big Brother and how this is a potential program run amok. But when you actually look at the details, then I think we've struck the right balance. And if people can't trust not only the executive branch, but also don't trust Congress and don't trust federal judges to make sure that we're abiding by the Constitution, due process, and rule of law, then we're going to have some problems here.
The Alex Jones Show, because there is a war on for your mind.
All that evil men in power seek to flourish is that good men and women do nothing. I think it was Edmund Burke said that, British statesman. There are good people in the government. The government's not our enemy. The big corporations are doing as much spying as the NSA in certain areas. It is the fact that we have let government and corporations get out of control. Now there's no oversight. They're doing whatever they want. It's crazy. William Binney, former technical director of the National Security Agency, one of the most high-level whistleblowers of all time. I mean, he has exposed Benedict Arnold-level crimes. They've tried to put him in prison and failed. They have successfully put other patriots in prison. They put journalists in prison. But for people in the government, better choose a side, because this is classic totalitarianism. Every top constitutional lawyer, whether they're liberal or conservative, has come out and said, we're going over the edge. This is scary. Even Congress is saying that, but there's no oversight, so it's just all out of control now. Now, there are centralized groups that have a lot of power, but the scariest thing is, if this was a centralized system, we could probably fix it a lot better. Am I right, from your expert opinion, that it's worse that there's not even oversight because there's all these mini empires and God knows what going on with just unlimited spying happening, and Congress doesn't know what to do? I mean, this is just crazy sounding. Is that worse than just having one centralized group running it because we could remove them? I mean, how do you ever get rid of something that's metastasized like this?
Well, that's one of the things that we put into suggestions of the president in January last year. We sent in 21 recommendations on how to fix NSA. One of them was to have our group of technical people be able to monitor everything. And we had another one to have focused collection of data. That kind of data is what's pulled into the NSA, not this bulk acquisition. That removes the possibility of them even querying that data, because now they can't even access it because it doesn't exist. So if you did a focused attack like we did with our program Thin Thread back in the 90s, that would have eliminated this bulk acquisition. They couldn't do what they're doing. No one could do love in at NSA. The FBI and CIA can't get into this data to do whatever they want to, like they can now, because it wouldn't be there.
They can't alter the data because they can't get to it.
They can now.
Yes, okay?
But because under the Thin Thread program, the data wouldn't even be stored there. They wouldn't have it. So they wouldn't be able to do anything with it. That was the point. We had a way of filtering out all domestic communications, metadata, content, everything. If it was domestic, it just passed right by. We could recognize it was domestic and not even take it in. So we never even acquired it. So it couldn't be stored in any NSA database. It couldn't be accessed by any NSA analyst or anybody in the CIA.
And so when you were there, the NSA was truly spying on foreign adversaries.
Yes, but at General Hayden, when he was director, and it was Bush, Cheney, Hayden, and Tenet that decided to spy on everybody. That was to expand the authority of an NSA to go into, in secret, by the way, to spy and collect data on every U.S. citizen and everybody on the planet. And so when they did that, that's when I first saw that coming in. That was when I had to wash my hands of NSA. I couldn't be any part of that. I had to leave because that was just I couldn't participate or even be associated with those crimes.
What did they say to you when you went into your superior's office? I guess that'd be the head of the NSA. And what did you say?
Actually, I didn't go to them at all. I went directly to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. The reason was I knew, very simply put, that everybody had been co-opted in the hierarchy of NSA.
They'd committed the crime.
Yes. They were all a party to it. All the lawyers, all of the senior managers at NSA had all followed orders from the White House, from Cheney and Bush, to do this. And that's what Hayden directed them to say, that this direction was coming from the White House. Therefore, we're going to do it. It's lawful, and
do it. To talk about what a hero and how much courage you've got, I mean, you know how serious people are in this government, what they do worldwide, how corrupt it's gotten at that point. You had the will to march into Congress and to tell them what was going on. The first guy, I mean, that's 10 times bigger than Snowden internally, and to really start this whole internal debate and this avalanche of understanding now, I mean, you were really one of the first people to ring the bell to warn folks that the country as we knew it was being dismantled.
Yes, and in order to do that, I had to meet with one of the staffers of the House Intelligence Committee, Diane Rourke, that I knew. So I met with her at her house because we couldn't trust the House Intelligence Committee because they were a part of it. And we also couldn't trust anybody in NSA. So the only place that we'd find we could be have a conversation or even talk about this was her house. There was no other place that was secure.
In the supposed free country of America. And then you get SWAT team. Tell folks about that.
Well, yeah, after that and after talking to other members of Congress, it was actually the morning of the second day after Attorney General Gonzalez's testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee on the terrorist surveillance program, where he only talked about the warrantless wiretap program. That was the part that was exposed.
And claimed it was for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, right. That's right. But that was only a smidgen of what they were doing. I mean, that was like an infinitesimal of what they were really taking in. At that time, it must have been a lower percentage of phone calls, but a vast majority of emails inside the United States as well as worldwide. which I estimated to be now at least 80% of the phone calls in the United States are now being recorded somewhere. That's how Tim Clemente could say that after the Boston bombing, we can get back to what was said in a phone call between one of the Tsarnaev brothers and his wife before the bombing.
Let's be clear. They're saying it on television that they're recording all the calls, but then denying it out of the next exactly. breath.
That was CNN. Also, Director Mueller of the FBI in his Senate Judiciary testimony in 30th of March of 2011 said that he got together with the Department of Defense and set up a database where he and the FBI could make one query and get all past and all future emails on a person. Now, that tells you that that's coming out of Bluffdale, by the way. All the data is being collected and stored. And so it's not just phone calls, it's emails, it's everything else. And of course, some of the recent publications show credit card use is being stored also.
How many people in the NSA, how many people have a high enough clearance in government agencies, period, to be able to go in and hear my phone calls, say, to my dad yesterday?
I believe the figures I've seen, at least though it's been published, is probably on the order of about 3,000 government employees. Now, that doesn't count contractors who are managing the data. That's the real rub. You have all these contractors who manage the communications, the computers, the data storage, the query programs, and the communications back and forth between the analysts to ensure all
who could do a Snowden-level breach if they want.
Snowden-level breach, yes. Yeah, because they don't have any monitoring system of them. Anybody with a system administrator or a super user case, which is what he has.
And people say there's no way Snowden could do it. No, it's like it's designed to bring the country down. It's like it's designed to end our national security, and then they're selling it as national security.
Well, that gets back to that program we wanted to put in place in 1991 or 92, which was well-grounded to monitor this. And we were opposed by the analysts and the administrator, the managers, because of all the material would expose that they were doing. But that meant that they left the entire network with no monitoring system at all. That's why they can't tell what Snowden took. They don't have any idea. They're guessing 1.7 million.
Records. What's behind an open border? What's behind an open NSA? What's behind, at the end of the day, what do you think the different power elites are thinking?
I basically see us moving to a controlled society, a totalitarian state where it is the government wants to be in charge. I mean, when Reagan said we're a country with a government, I think we're now a government with a country. And all of the things that are happening are only tightening that control on the people. They're going to manipulate them and keep, as long as they can keep them uninformed and nobody realizes what's going on, or they don't see the threat. If they say, you have nothing, if you've done nothing wrong, you have nothing to hide. First of all, that's a great quote from Joseph Goebbels. And secondly, that's totally irrelevant.
Yeah, they're actually quoting Joseph Goebbels on a routine basis.
Yeah.
It's like satire.
It's like the lies they keep saying. That's right out of Hitler's playbook. If you're going to tell a lie, make it a big one and tell it frequently till it's believed. And that's what's going on here. And we're assuming that we trust our government, so we're assuming they're telling us the truth. Well, that's just wrong.
It's just a bunch of corporations and private contractors screwing us up.
For money, yes. I've been basically said what they did after 9/11 was trade the security of the people of the United States and of the world for money.
And we are back on this Easter transmission. I want to go to our archives and play part of an interview that David Knight and Paul Joseph Watson of InfoWars.com did recently with a true American political prisoner, Barrett Brown. An interview from jail. He's in prison for exercising his free speech. You know this country's in danger when stuff like this is happening. Let's go to the interview.
Let's go to Barrett Brown. Barrett, I wanted to give you a chance to talk to the public. We talked about your comments to the judge saying that this isn't about the rule of law anymore. We now have the rule of law enforcement. Tell us what you want to tell us about your trial now that the gag order has been taken off.
Well, the first thing I should mention is that aside from what I put forth in the article for the Daily Beast about a month ago, and aside from what I'll tell you about today, the great majority of the things that people need to know about the trial are still sealed, and that should continue for about 6 months. So, in addition to all the very egregious things that have happened, there's a great deal more that's still not public. Now, regarding the trial, I guess the basic lesson here is that the federal government can do whatever it wants, essentially, within the Department of Justice, within the federal justice system. That's clear from the extent of the perjury, very demonstrable perjury that occurred in this case, again, some of which is visible, some of which can be confirmed publicly through documents, some of which is still sealed. And that's really what I've tried to convey to the judge in that the allocution I gave, is that, you know, when you allow this perjury to occur, we're getting away from the rule of law. We're getting to a situation in which we're going through the forms. We're meeting in a nice, very pretty hardwood room with paintings, and it's a big, nice wood podium and very pretty robes and all that. But you're missing something, which is the rule of law. And to the extent the rule of law isn't there, you're going to see things like Anonymous. You're going to see things like WikiLeaks. You're going to keep seeing them until we get the rule of law.
One of the things, reading the transcript, the judge dressed down the prosecutor for not referring to you as Mr. Brown. And I, as you're just talking about, you got this fancy room with all the trappings and everything, but they're grinding the rule of law into the ground. And I thought, he's worried about being polite to people while he's doing that, while he's railroading this whole process. That was amazing.
That kind of thing is very important to establishment characters in D.C. It's very important to the people who have that federal government mentality. You know, I would have preferred him to object at the last hearing when the prosecutor asked the FBI agent, how long has Barry Brown been an anarchist? Mm-hmm. That would have been the time to object, when they started asking about my political ideology. Incidentally, this thing about me being an anarchist, which is true, that actually comes up in a couple of other documents, including the gag order, when they asked for me to be gagged. Me being an anarchist was one of the reasons they cited. In one of the documents that's still sealed regarding my sentencing, they call for me to get additional prison time because I'm an anarchist, and thus more likely, apparently, to commit crimes. So there's a lot of egregious things that, on an individual basis, really should have been a national story, you know, on each given thing. Obviously, the seizure of the Declaration of Independence, in a more perfect world, would have been a major news story.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the world we're in, it didn't quite rate national coverage.
Yes, that was amazing. Tell the audience about that.
Well, among the items, and you can see this, and this is links to from my Daily Beast article, my post, Cyberpunk Indentured Servitude, which you can find online. You know, we have the list of items they seized as, you know, evidence of a crime. And you know, it's computers, it's my notes. There's only one book they took. I have a lot of books in my apartment at the time, and the only book they took was a copy of the Declaration of Independence, just this little pocket copy.
Well, that's radical.
Never have to explain why they took it. I'm assuming it has to do something to do with the FBI memorandum a few years ago when they said, you know, patriots, militia types, they like the Constitution, they might have a copy of the Constitution. Thus, having a copy of the Constitution might be evidence of a crime. I'm assuming they just sort of got it mixed up. One of those Enlightenment documents. You know, FBI agents aren't as educated as we might expect them to be, or might hope them to be anyway. So they just grabbed it and then, you know, never came up at the trial. Would have been, even for them, it would have been a little much to actually discuss that, you know, in the course of the trial. So
one of the things you mentioned at the end of the article was 2 days before your sentencing, the Department of Justice withheld from the defense team chat transcripts from Jeremy Hammond. Tell us about that.
This call is from a federal prison.
Sorry, that's one of those charming little reminders every once in a while. Yes, it actually came out 2 days before in an article by, I think, Dale Cameron, that, in fact, and this is something we had no idea of, the Department of Justice had documents that show quite demonstrably that I was not a co-conspirator in the Strapper hack, which was a major point, you know, of the DOJ's favor in getting me, you know, actually getting me initial prison time, this claim that I was somehow a co-conspirator. And they withheld that evidence. And the evidence is now public. It was made public right before my sentencing. And this is something that, again, in a more perfect world, the judge would care about just as much as he cares about whether I'm called Mr. Brown or Barrett or Humpty Dumpty or whatever. But it just didn't quite come to his attention. Didn't quite interest him very much. It actually just goes to show that this particular case, obviously, it's inconvenient for me to be in prison. But on the other hand, we have a great example here. This whole case, the investigation, all the way to the sentencing, of how this system works. Particularly if the DOJ wants you, you know, very much wants you to do prison time. It's just a great example of how they're able to get away with these things, even in the public eye. There's the other story here, of course, is how poorly the mainstream media does in keeping up with these things.
Absolutely. Well, we spoke on the phone the other day, Barrett, and you were talking about, I was asking you what you knew about the Michael Hastings case, and how the FBI came out and said that they weren't looking into him. And you said that you believe that, you know, 99% that FBI was definitely looking to him.
Yeah, it's even aside from the other reasons they would have to look into him, it's absolutely ludicrous for them to say that, because with regards to my group, Project PM, which runs the Echelon2.org website, which was really what this case was all about, you know, they subpoenaed the IP address information for everyone who's ever contributed to that website of ours. And So these are just sort of small players within Project PM. Now, Michael Hastings, on the other hand, as I noted in a Vanity Fair article a number of years ago when he was still alive and when I was writing about him, he was instrumental when I was first creating Project PM in helping me sort of flesh out the philosophy of it. So the idea that he, who was in contact with me regarding Project PM, was never investigated regarding Project PM is absolutely 100% ludicrous. And again, that's in addition to the other reasons they and certain other organizations would have to be investigating and harassing him. He obviously did a great job. He's best known for sort of forcing McChrystal to resign a number of years ago. But really, his article exposing the PSYOPs campaign used by, I believe, a two-star general in Afghanistan against visiting senators, that's something I cite constantly in my articles for The Guardian or wherever as evidence of here's what these people are willing to do even to your elected officials.
Obviously, one of the charges is the fact that he merely provided a link to the Stratfor email leaks. What kind of precedent does that create for web publishers, for activists going forward?
Well, it means that the federal government now has a vastly expanded toolkit, by which to come after anyone that they wanted to come after to begin with, whether or not they've actually committed a crime. By criminalizing the act of linking, especially in my case when you don't even know what you're linking to, and had no interest or use for the, and this turned out to be credit card numbers in addition to other information that I ended up linking to, which was already public. That sets a terrible precedent by which journalists, researchers are now at risk. And of course, there are some journalists and researchers who are a danger to the government, and especially the DOJ, and thus, you know, the DOJ now has one more option by which to come after them. Quinn Norton, who writes for Wired and who testified at my hearing, she explained a few days afterwards, after this decision, that she was going to stop doing security reporting. It's too dangerous. She told this to the judge. The judge at my hearing said, you know, well, I'm going to go ahead and hit him with this additional year in prison for the linking. I don't think it's going to be a concern to journalists, which is bizarre because, of course, journalists have been expressing concern about those charges ever since they were made 2 years ago. And even right after my sentencing, there was a number of articles in U.S. News and World Report, Columbia Journalism Review, The Intercept, again, expressing concern about this. So the judge is not a brilliant flower of jurisprudence or anything, really. He's just sort of a puppet of the DOJ. Unfortunately, not a bad guy, just doesn't know what he's doing. And so, again, alas, that's that situation we're in now. Now, hopefully something will come of this in the case in general. Hopefully people will make use of what's happened in my case to bring some attention to the mainstream. Because, again, this affects journalists. And, you know, when you start coming after journalists, then you have the option, the potential to get journalists' attention.
Especially when you're quoting someone, a Fox News contributor, and then they use that against you, that quote.
Yeah, and that's really, I think, the number one most bizarre thing in a comedy of bizarre errors. The fact that a Fox News commentator went on television and talked about how we should murder Julian Assange. Mm-hmm. I quoted that on my Twitter account. You know, and of course, Julian Assange is someone who I respect and he respects me. We have sort of an association. That ended up in my indictment, as if it was something that I said or you know, approved of. And even after we pointed out, you know, in a filing that, you know, this Barrett Brown didn't say this. This is some other guy that Barrett Brown obviously wouldn't get along with saying it. The prosecution stuck with it. Instead of saying, oh, this is a mistake, or you're right, they stuck with it and said, yes, he's promoting this quote, which, mm-hmm. Again, really raises the question of if this is a terrible quote that even promoting gets you indicted, then how come the guy who said it on national television hasn't been indicted? And the answer, of course, is because the guy on Fox News is not a danger to the DOJ. He's commentators are both left.
We'll be right back after this quick break in the second hour. And I'm going to go beyond saying don't touch that dial. Spread the word on Facebook, Twitter. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in to the second hour of information. This is going to be jam-packed with Daniel Esten on the Bilderberg Group, Dr. Wakefield on the danger of vaccines, the top lawyer and former head lawyer for the FCC, Bruce Fine, will document the power grab happening right now with the FCC and the Internet. All this and more in the second hour, so stay with us. We are now into the second hour on this Easter edition. I want to thank all of you for listening and spreading the word. I'm Alex Jones. We're now going to go to a special report from InfoWars Nightly News. And when we return, we'll have excerpts of an extremely important interview we did with investigative journalist, best-selling author Daniel Estulin on the secrets of the Bilderberg Group, then Dr. Wakefield, Bruce Fine, and more.
There is an extra special and rare total lunar eclipse taking place this Saturday morning. It has some people worried for this Easter weekend. The blood moon is a rare celestial event, yet for the third time in less than a year, the moon will dip behind the Earth's shadow, appearing a deep coppery red for a few minutes. And this will transform the skies over North America, Asia, and Australia into a deep red color. Now, there are several interesting things about this particular blood moon. While some eclipses can last an hour or more, this will be the shortest lunar eclipse of this century. It's also taking place the morning of Easter Vigil, which is traditionally observed as the period between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. The eclipse also falls within the first night of Passover, which is observed by Jews worldwide beginning Friday at sunset. Now, according to NASA, the rare tetrad of four alignments in close proximity has only happened a handful of times in the last 2,000 years. The final blood moon eclipse of the tetrad series will take place September 28, 2015, which also happens to be a Jewish holiday. Many people believe that these lunar eclipses and their appearance on auspicious dates signals a world-changing event that's about to take place.
The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. Joel 2:31.
Now, there's something else about this tetrad series that's pretty bizarre. It happens to fall in a Shemitah year. This is something that hasn't happened for 2,000 years. Rabbi Jonathan Kahn points out in his book, The Mystery of the Shemitah, that these years in the past have brought down economies, kingdoms, and nations that haven't followed God's will.
A very major thing happened that escaped most people. The Shemitah began in the autumn of 2014, and what happened is within 1 week of it beginning, and remember the Shemitah can mean the fall, within 1 week, America was overtaken. Russia became the greatest nuclear power on Earth. It actually surpassed it the first week of the Shemitah. The second week of the Shemitah came something even more major, and that is that the American age that began in the year 1871, when we became the strongest economic power on Earth, came to an end. America was dethroned. As the Shemitah began, it is now China has taken the crown of America. Now, I've warned since the Harbinger came out, I've warned that if we don't turn back to God, there is going to be the crown that America has worn as the head of nations going to be removed. We are seeing the beginning of that right now. And so we are watching actually when the same week that the Shemitah began, Wall Street went crazy for about a month. Now, the pattern of the last Shemitahs have been that often at the beginning of the Shemitah, you don't notice anything, but there are often foreshadows. Well, the major thing, if something's going to happen, the major period is going to be coming up is always at the end of the Shemitah as we approach September. That's the time of that wipeout. I'm not saying it has to happen, but I believe we need to be aware of it. And interesting, people who look at signs, one of the signs in the Bible of judgment is the darkening of the sun or an eclipse. Not that it always is, but it can be. On the day that we get to the wipeout day, Elul 29 of this Shemitah cycle, the sun's going to be darkened at that time. The last time that happened was 1987, when the sun was darkened at Elul 29. It led into Black Monday, the worst day crash in world history. I believe we are going to watch, if we don't turn back, if this nation keeps on going on its course, we're going to watch the fall of America or the shaking of America. And the American age that you and I and all our listeners have known since we were born is going to come to an end.
You can witness this rare event for yourself. The action starts at 5:16 a.m. Central Standard Time on the morning of April 4th. The Earth's shadow will slowly move across the moon, covering it entirely just before 7 a.m.
He's the T-Rex of political talk. Alex Jones on the GCN Radio Network.
Daniel S. Estulin is one of the only living people who has connections into the Bilderberg Group. I get some intel from people on the periphery, but I do not have a source directly inside Bilderberg. Daniel Estulin has written several international bestsellers on the Bilderberg Group. He's also written a thinly veiled fiction that, of course, really isn't fiction at a lot of levels. Just like Ian Fleming's James Bond novels were true stories put into a composite. And he now has released a documentary we're going to be telling you about today. So he's got the big scoop on where it may be held this year. Is it accurate, as some are saying, that it's going to be in Austria? And a lot more. Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Alex, it's always a great, enormous pleasure for me to be on the show. You and I go way back. In 2006, we had together, standing right in front of the Bilderberg Hotel in Kanata, Ottawa, when you were arrested, if you remember. Of course, you remember.
Yes.
Just before you came to Canada. And so we've been doing this for a long, long time. And, of course, Jim Tucker was with us. He's no longer with us. But there's a lot of people out there who are doing what they can to make sure that this story doesn't die. And, again, this global awareness, which you were talking about before, on the world stage, people are becoming aware more and more what's going on as a result of technological revolution, internet and everything else out there. It's getting more and more difficult for the global elite to hide their deeds.
Looking at what's happening, why do you think they're coming show out in the open? And then you've got the floor, because I could ask questions, but I want to know what's on your mind, the latest intel you've gotten.
Well, the Bilderberg meeting is being held actually in 2015 in Austria on my Twitter account at Estrel and Daniel. I published a couple of months ago an information, a report that I got from my intel sources in the Ministry of the Interior of Austria, who sent me the report saying which dates that everybody in Austria has to be on the lookout. There is no holidays that week. I believe it's from the 9th of, I can't remember exactly the date right now, but it's the beginning of June, and it is being held in Austria, and we have the documents to demonstrate it. As far as what's going on in the world, the globalist elite, the reason actually all this information is coming out right now, Alex, is that the global elite are faced with the reality of seeking to dominate populations that are increasingly becoming self-aware and are developing a global consciousness. Thus, a population being subjected to domination in Africa, for example, has the ability to become aware of a population being subjected to the same forms of domination in the Middle East, in South America, or in Asia, or even in Europe, in Greece, for example. And they can recognize that they're all being dominated by the same global power structures. And that is the key point. Not only is the awakening global in its reach, but also in its nature. It creates within the individual an awareness of the global condition. So it is a global awakening, both in the external environment and also in the internal psychology. And this is something that the elitists, such as the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, Council for Relations, Pinay Circle, Bohemian Grove, and all this, you know, ONGs, Rockefeller Foundations, Carnegie's, every, you know, Hudson's and Hoover's, they simply, you know, can't deal with it right now because it's a new game. And this new reality in the world comes with the fact, Alex, that the world's population has never been so vast, presents a challenge to elites seeking to dominate people all over the world who are aware and awaken to the realities of social inequality, to war, poverty, exploitation, disrespect, imperialism, and domination. And of course, this directly implies that these populations will be significantly more challenging to control, both economically, politically, socially, psychologically, and also spiritually.
By the way, we're rolling some background footage of your new film, and I tell you, it looks like better than something you'd see on HBO. The camera work, the research, I cannot wait to see this. Tell us about your new documentary, Daniel, and how soon we can get a copy of it. I'd love to sell it on DVD or Blu-ray once it comes out at my store, but I hope it goes in theaters first. Tell people the name. Tell us all about this incredible documentary on the Bilderberg Group that you've produced.
Well, we actually, we're in a post-production now. The film comes out at the end of May, beginning of June. We've been at it for about 4 years. It's our production. We've done interviews in 11 countries, Canada, the United States, most of Europe. We've traveled up and down all over the place. The first producer of the documentary was actually wiped out economically, if you believe in conspiracy or coincidence theories, when three banks called in loans on the same day, and that basically bankrupted him. So he actually.
And by the way, I separately know about this, not from you, but I know who the group was. Are we allowed to say who they were, or we shouldn't talk about it?
You can if you want, exactly.
Was that the guys with the Halcyon group?
No. The Halcyon group, that's the major motion picture.
Yeah, that's the folks that made Terminator, that they also came after them and took them over to stop your film getting made, right?
These are not the people who are producing the documentary. These are the people in Spain, independent producers, people who...
So this has happened twice, then, if I'm correct.
This happened twice, once with the major motion picture, and now with the documentary, which is why it took us a bit longer. But it's almost in the post-production stages. I tell you a little anecdote. I sent a letter, an email to Martin Wolf, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Financial Times, and I asked him for an interview, and I got a reply, and of course we're going to put it in the documentary. He sent an email, how dare you make a documentary about the Bilderberg Group? So the documentary is coming out at the beginning of June, end of May. We're in a post-production, and, you know, we're very, very close to the finish line. We're going to be over that finish line, and the film is going to be out. Worldwide release. There's a lot of international large film festivals who are very interested. And also Bilderberg has become a household name. The book came out 10 years ago, and now everybody knows about it, and I think this is the time. It's the right time, socially speaking, with all the changes taking place in the world, that people think finally are ready to embrace this concept that you've been talking about for about over a decade, and, you know, I've been talking about it for over a decade.
Well, you've got Nigel Farage in here. You've got just an amazing list of top people in your film. I cannot wait to see this. What's the name of the film?
It's called The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. It's based, obviously, on my book. It's actually the first documentary which is based on a book. Most documentaries, you know, are not based on books. But this one is based on my book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. I get it's going to be out in theaters end of May, beginning of June. And when it's out, needless to say, I'd be more than happy and pleased to go back on your show and talk about it.
In closing, I know you've got sources. I know a lot of it now is pretty much as you said last time you were on, is put out at Davos, but what's on the agenda for 2015 in Switzerland or in Austria?
One of the key issues, Alex, is fiscal austerity. You know, this boogeyman term is back. It's kind of a vague term that is, you know, actually refers to cutting social spending and increasing taxes. And the effect this has is that the public sector is devastated as all assets are privatized, public workers, you know, are fired en masse, unemployment becomes rampant, health and education disappear, taxes rise dramatically, and currencies are devalued to make all assets cheaper for international corporations and banks to buy up, while internally causing inflation, dramatically increasing the costs of fuel and food. And in short, fiscal austerity implies social destruction, as we're seeing right now in Greece, as we saw in Spain, as we saw in Portugal, and as we're seeing, you know, in Italy. And, you know, the social destruction of the social foundations of nations and peoples are pulled out from under them. States then become despotic and oppress the people who naturally revolt against austerity. And this is called the sterilization of society. And this is the term, again, this is the term, Alex, you're going to be seeing a lot more, you know, with the build-up to Bilderberg and then post-Bilderberg. We talked about this before, you know, terms like deindustrialization, zero growth, demand destruction. You know, they were discussed at these private secret meetings, and then suddenly they were front and center in major newspapers. Next big front and center newspaper piece is sterilization of society. It sounds awful, just the word sterilization itself with all the connotations. When you start sterilizing society, it takes on a meaning of its own. It takes it, you know, to an nth degree, you know, of evil that, needless to say, we have to make sure we fight this.
On the other side of this break, we're going to be talking to Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who's recently been exonerated for his research on the connection between vaccines and autism.
They took my saddle in Houston, broke my leg in Santa Fe. my wife and a girlfriend somewhere along the way.
In defense of human liberty, Alex Jones.
I'll be looking for aid when they pull that gate. And I hope that judge ain't blind.
Dr. Wakefield, I can ask questions. I can rant and rave. Brief the people out there where we are now in this totalitarian push to force inoculation. Now it's do or die. We're close to breaking their back. That's why we're seeing their Battle of the Bulge moment when, let's just compare them to Hitler. We've driven them back. We're winning. And they hit us with everything they've got. But you can see that Zeb Dietrich out there leading this attack doesn't have the moral high ground, he's going to fail. I don't care how big and black his army tanks are. The ground troops are out there with their bazookas. We're taking these tanks out right now. Let's talk about what's happening. You've got the floor.
And here's the thing. Those congressional, they're in the recess next week. So they are coming back, many of them, to their district. You can go and meet them in your district. You don't have to travel to D.C., but you make sure that every congressman in this country is aware of exactly what's going on. Because at the moment, pharma lobbyists are scaling Capitol Hill like orcs storming Helm's Deep. It's a hideous sight. And even though...
You can see their huge offensive. I mean, this is Battle of the Bulge. I mean, they're throwing everything they've got.
And this is a matter between Congress and a congressional agency or a federal agency, the CDC. It shouldn't involve the pharma lobbyists at all. The congressman should have the... Chutzpah, say to them, this is none of your business. You may be indirectly affected by the outcome of this, but this is between us and a federal agency that has committed an alleged fraud. So get out of my office and wait for the result.
Well, think about with government-run healthcare that's run by special interests and written by it, they can just make us buy whatever, quote, health products they want, including tainted vaccines. This is super high-tech slavery. I mean, this is over the top.
Yeah, so please go to autismmediachannel.com, download those PDF documents, and get them in front of your representative. Do not hesitate. Next week, they will be back in district, and they will be available to you. So make it happen, because if we lose this battle, we lose it for a very, very long time.
Elaborate on where's the lawsuit going, how your colleague, the co-author, super prestigious. I mean, I looked him up, like you said, one of the top gastro experts in the UK or Europe. That's why they were so scared of you guys and had to shut you down, because you're smart, well-spoken, prestigious, getting results, helping people, had to be destroyed. But they failed. You came back like the Phoenix, and that's so exciting. So break down where that fight's going right now as well.
Certainly. Let me start with John Walker Smith. When the GMC rendered their opinion and had their decision and had us struck off the medical register in the UK, both Professor Walker Smith and I filed an appeal. And I did not get funded for my appeal. It would have cost me about £500,000, which I didn't have, to fight that appeal. So I had to withdraw mine.
Because they destroyed your livelihood.
That's right. His was funded, and he took it to the High Court. This was the first time it had ever been in front of a proper judiciary. The judge, Justice Mitting, destroyed the GMC, destroyed them. He essentially accused them of being incompetent, unable to handle evidence. They did not know how to. He accused them of being biased. They rejected evidence that was valid. They had no idea what they were doing. Yes, they did, actually, because they were doing it deliberately.
Well, they were setting you up.
They had been given their marching orders, and they were going to get a guilty verdict, whatever. And at the end of it, counsel on behalf of the GMC admitted, said, we're sorry. We know mistakes were made, and we didn't handle this properly. And the judge said, it would be a shame if this were ever to happen again. You go away and you change your whole process of conducting these fitness to practice inquiries. So it was demolished. However, they got what they wanted, and that was taking my license away.
And now autism rates have gone, I mean, they vary. The highest are in South Korea, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like 1 in 30-something. It's 1 in 50-something here now. It was 1 in 68. It was 1 in 25,000 30 years ago. I mean, I can see the children when I'm at the grocery store or I'm out in public. Kids aren't looking too good. And the babies aren't, and I mean, you go to a movie theater, sometimes the thing is just full of autistic children, God bless their little hearts, you know, babbling, and just going through hell. And I go to doctor's offices sometimes to, you know, take my children to the pediatrician, and I'll be in there and there's like 15 kids and like five of them are autistic. I mean, this is an epidemic. Is it going to be 1 in 10, 1 in 5, 1 in 2? I mean, how long will this go? How many? I mean, does half the population have to be sitting in the corner in diapers, cussing when they're 15 years old, screaming at their parents before we do something?
I think the way to look at this, Alex, is look at the CDC's own numbers on this and look at the trend over time. It's now, what, as you say, around 1 in 50. If you extrapolate from that and you look at the risk for autism for a child born today, it's 1 in 25. And it's estimated that by 2025, it will be 1 in 2 children will have autism if nothing is done about it. And that is completely, the situation now is completely unacceptable. But that will be a disaster. No economy in the world can sustain that kind of attrition of its population. So something has got to be done immediately.
Well, yeah, something was done. Have you read Eco-Science, written by the current White House science czar?
I have not.
It's pretty interesting. They talk about social engineering through medical systems, water and vaccines to get people in line. Yeah. Pretty interesting. It was written by, they think there's too many people, Paul R. Ehrlich, Annie H. Ehrlich, and John P. Holdren. And this book is digitally online for free. They try to pull it down when people find it, because it's pretty shocking. This was basically adopted by UNESCO as a global shadow policy to carry out social engineering through medicine.
Right. Well, keep an eye on your copy, Alex. I might have to steal it before I go.
Well, you can borrow it. You're certainly welcome to.
Thank you. But, and the other issue is, what happens? Okay, there are two elements to this. There's the epidemic that's occurring now, and then there are the children who are already damaged. What do we do about those children as they age out and they become adults? As you say, sitting in diapers at the age of 15, 20, 25, unable to cope, unable to deal with themselves. And we had a tragic case here in Austin the other day of a young man who was in a group home in the district, in the community, and a simple thing happened. I think someone stood on a DVD of his. He had a meltdown. He went running around the district, knocking on doors, and he was shot 4 times, shot to death. That these people cannot cope in the community. They have no idea.
It's scary when a 25-year-old autistic man's at your door, yeah, and we're sad he got shot. But, I mean, and cops are shooting them all the time, too, because you get some guy running at you screaming. I mean, it's...
Yeah. And nobody understands the problem. This is the problem. The people out there in the community do not understand what autism is or that these individuals have no sense of danger whatsoever. So what are we going to do with all of these autistic adults? And that's a tragedy, and someone here in Austin, Polly Tommy, is creating the Autism Trust to provide a long-term home for these individuals where they won't be drugged. They won't be simply put on psychotropic medications which have no indication in autism whatsoever but make life easier for the carers.
I met him out in Lakeway.
Polly is, you probably met her husband.
Husband, yeah.
The husband and wife team. And
he was showing me all the stuff they're going to build the campus. Pretty amazing.
Absolutely, that's right. So, It's an exciting time for people here in Austin, but one of these places is not going to be anywhere near enough. You could deal where you could have 10 or 15 in Austin alone, let alone the rest of Texas or the country.
Well, I know a lot of personal friends, some quite famous people as well. I mean, you'll be on the phone with them, and, you know, their kids in the background going just over and over again screaming at them, I mean, for hour after hour after hour. I mean, it is... I couldn't think of a way to debilitate a society better.
We'll be back with the conclusion of this important interview with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Then we'll talk to the former top lawyer at the FCC about the FCC power grab of the entire internet and media system.
Crashing through the lies and disinformation, it's Alex Jones on the GCN Radio Network.
Wakefield, again, we salute you for your groundbreaking work. And, you know, Galileo said that the Earth wasn't the center of the world, and they locked him up for the rest of his life. So we haven't gotten to that level, though they've been trying. And so we appreciate you.
Alex, thank you very much. It's great to be back. I think you're absolutely right. What we're looking at is a system that is in meltdown right now, and they're in meltdown for a number of reasons. You can only sustain a lie, a falsehood for so long. And now that Dr. William Thompson, senior CDC scientist, has come forward and said that they have known for 13 years that MMR vaccine is causally associated with autism, and they have hidden it from the public, from doctors, from public health officials, from everybody. They've kept it to an inner circle of people who knew the truth all along and have allowed millions of children to be put in harm's way in the interim. And he could no longer live with that, and he's come forward with that now. And one has to hope that that goes before a congressional committee sooner rather than later. And if I have one message for your listeners and your viewers, it is that you must implore that your congressman take this very, very seriously and support Congressman Bill Posey's efforts to get this before a committee just as soon as possible.
Looking at this now, they're doubling down. It's like we're Jews in Nazi Germany that we don't want to get vaccinated. Arrest us, publish our names, where we live, come after us, take our children. I mean, they're really doubling down.
It's desperate, isn't it? And it's rather like Salem, or more recently, as you point out, it's rather like the Nazis banning Jews from using public transportation in order to avoid being contaminated by suspected infection. I mean, it's absolutely disgraceful.
Oh, that's what they said. Yeah, you're right.
So we're seeing that kind of reaction now to what's happening. And it's very well orchestrated. It's heavily funded with billions of dollars of public relations fund, and it's failing. It's failing.
It is failing.
Because it's a lie. And if you have a vaccination policy in this country which mandates, which takes your children away, which puts you at gunpoint, which puts parents in prison for not vaccinating, that is not built upon public trust or confidence. That is a disaster. And public health policy, vaccination policy, requires the confidence of the public, and they have lost it.
Wow, this is epic. Think about it. In America and Europe, they're trying to make vaccines forced, and they're coming out with hundreds of new ones where companies lobby, and then government says it's the law to take it. They tried to have Rick Perry a few years ago run the hoax of saying it was the law with the Gardasil. I mean, there's no end to the depths. And as you said, I'm here following it. I'm here talking to the public. They're doubling, tripling down. It is backfiring. But it shows this totalitarian instinct that now permeates government.
Yeah, the notion of treating or protecting children against serious infectious disease with safe and effective vaccines is a laudable one. We both recognize.
I want them.
Absolutely. But the current schedule, and certainly MMR, meets none of those criteria. None at all. And we have a major, major problem. Let me characterize this. There are measles outbreaks apparently now in California and elsewhere. MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, does not protect against measles. Measles vaccine protects against measles. And the only recommendation that I have ever made in respect of MMR, is to give them separately and delay them so that you have an interval between each vaccine.
That's what the Japanese have done for 20 years.
Well, the Japanese are an extremely good example because the Japanese had MMR.
They don't want a bunch of brain-damaged children.
When MMR came in Japan, there was a dramatic rise in the incidence of autism. What they found is that the vaccine caused meningitis. The mumps strain of the vaccine caused meningitis. Public confidence was lost, and the vaccine was stopped. And the uptake of the vaccine and the decline in the use of the vaccine exactly mirrors the rising and falling incidence of autism. Now, what happened next was that there was a dramatic rebound in the incidence of autism. It went up, skyrocketed. Why? They never used MMR again. But what the vaccine policy recommendation was in Japan was to use to give children at 12 months the measles and rubella vaccine on the same day, and to give voluntary mumps vaccination not less than 4 weeks later. Now, that, in many ways, is still giving combination viral vaccines. So you're recapitulating the same problem that you have with MMR. Now, the kicker is, Alex, that the single mumps vaccine, the one that caused meningitis, when it was given on its own, caused little or no meningitis at all. It was when it was put into the MMR that there was an unacceptable level of meningitis. What does that tell us? It tells us that you get a novel, unexpected, adverse event associated with the combination vaccine that you did not get with the single.
And you studied this. Dr. Blaylock, who's coined a lot of terms that are now in mainline medical journals, says that there's basically an adjuvant effect of mixing them together. It just makes them many times more powerful. Mixing them, or what is it?
It certainly alters their behavior. And this was recognized as soon as they were put together. It's called viral interference. And they were concerned that it influences the protective immune response. There was no concern whatsoever, except amongst the Japanese, about safety. No concern. You cannot take three live viral agents and put them into combination and just expect that one and one and one equal three. They don't.
And I saw they're now coming out with some vaccines that are flooding that have as many as 10?
Yes. For example, with the live viral vaccines, they put in the chickenpox vaccine. When they did that, it doubled the rate of febrile convulsions. There, again, is a classic example of more is not better.
But these inserts say they can give you convulsions. So why are we being attacked when the insert says all this?
I wonder how many patients or parents actually get to see that insert. Alex, I wonder how many people ask for it, and I wonder how many doctors spontaneously show it as part of the informed consent process. Very, very few.
Well, we told folks that there were some tips on to win the lottery in here, or maybe fantasy football, they might read it. But, I mean, if I was going to put any drug I'm going to put in my body, I don't care what it is, antibiotics, anything, I go read the insert.
You want to know what's in there.
This is just crazy. And for those that don't know, each vial of the MMR, any other vaccine or drug, in the box with it, by law, comes this. So they have this at Walgreens, at CVS.
I think parents need the choice. They need the choice. In the presence of the current concerns about the safety of MMR vaccine, they must have a choice of how to protect their children against infectious disease.
Well, I know you're here warning people, you know, as a doctor and, you know, trying to save folks, but tell us about your story, recapping it briefly, where it is, where your lawsuit is, your co-author being exonerated. I know you're moving towards that. You've been exonerated with the whistleblowers, the previous studies. But this has got to really hurt the people that tried to destroy you, as just fate would have it, all this evidence pours out.
Well, Alex, I've been in this 20 years now, and that's feels like many, many lifetimes. But we listened to parents who said that my child was perfectly normal. I'm not anti-vaccine. I took my child to get vaccinated. When I did that, they got the MMR, and they regressed into autism. And they also developed gastrointestinal symptoms. And as a physician interested in gastrointestinal disease, I recommended those children should get investigated for that. They were investigated by the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist at the time, Professor Walker Smith, who you've just mentioned, my co-author on the paper, and he found that they had an inflammatory bowel disease. We treated that disease. Not only did the bowel disease symptoms improve, but the behavioral and autistic symptoms improved. It was the beginning of a fascinating journey, but we had to investigate whether the parents were also right about whether the vaccine had precipitated in this. That's when the problem started. And so Murdoch's brought his team of journalists along, Brian Deere. They came up with this extraordinary story that we had involved ourselves in fraud and deception, that we had made it up, there was no ethical approval, all of this kind of thing, while at the same time holding back from the General Medical Council inquiry vital documents that showed there was indeed ethical approval for this study. He knew throughout the investigation and the proceedings that he had in his possession key documents. That was an obstruction of justice.
Have you ever physically been around this guy? If I was you, I bet you get angry.
I get angry, but, you know, it's not about me. It's not about me, Alex.
No, I know, but, I mean, this guy's trying to cover up what's going on with children. He's a despicable character, in my opinion.
Yeah, one thing I cannot forgive him for is the damage done to the children, because now we are many, many years on, and because the bowel disease in the minds of many was synonymous with vaccine injury, that had to be declared a fraud as well.
Because people were getting such good results in slowing or reversing it, God forbid we get a treatment for this.
That's right, and the trouble is that all of those children did not get investigated because doctors were terrified of doing the right thing.
From Austin, Texas, it's Alex Jones.
Bruce Fine, former general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, uniquely positioned to be able to really tell us what's going on. I've never seen behavior like I've seen from the executive, and then the Republican leadership seems to roll over because they're licking their lips, I guess, to have all this power when they get a president in charge. So, again, I'm worried about an imperial presidency, not even so much Obama. But I am shocked by the left that if Bush was trying something like this, you would have just heard howls. And now they say, hey, you know, a lot of make Obama a dictator. He can give us some free stuff then. Just incredible political ignorance. So please finish up on that, Mr. Fine.
It's very, very important, Alex, in a democratic country like ours, you know, that we have government in the sunshine. There are a few things that need to be secret location of truth, but relatively few. Transparency, sunshine is said to be the best disinfectant. So we have a right to know what our government is doing. How can we give consent to a government that's acting in secret? And so the whole idea that, and when I was working as counsel on the Iran-Contra Committee, this is during Reagan period. I mean, President Reagan was having Secretary of State George Shultz testify, his National Security Advisor was testifying, Cap Weinberger was testifying, Secretary of Defense. It was all open in the sunshine. This is President Reagan. And now we have people like, you know, chairman of the FCC, I don't want to answer questions. I don't want to show up. Well, the Congress should be telling you, one, if you don't show up, we will impeach and remove you from office because you have an obligation to explain to the American people what you're doing and why, because you are their representative. You work for them, not for Obama. You work for we, the people who are sovereign. And if they are recalcitrant, they should impeach them or fine them $50,000, $100,000 every day that they don't appear. And you're right, it's stunning. Congress says, well, please tell us. You know, they wring their hands and do nothing. So they get treated, you know, like they're second and then third tier players because they simply won't stand up and defend their authorities. Now, maybe you're right. They're just waiting for the White House so that they can be the oppressors rather than the oppressed. But that's not a very optimistic outlook for the future of the country. And I don't want to be oppressed by anybody in the White House.
Exactly.
Or a Democrat.
Well, also, they promised to release the 332 pages as soon as they announced it, and then they haven't released it, and are now have the Washington Post making fun of anybody that asked to see it when we know they printed it up in book form and they've been waving it around on TV for a month with this red tape around it. So I guess if they don't testify to Congress, why ever release it? They can be like the CIA. It'll just be secret.
Yeah, I mean, and say, secret government is antithetical to anything like representative democracy. How can you have a government that doesn't even tell you what it's doing? After all, we get to decide to approve or disapprove what's being done here. They don't get to issue by decree. You know, there are elections and things can change. And there's this arrogance that's totally antithetical to what our founding fathers thought, you know, a free and open government would be about.
Other points, where do you expect this to go? The Hill, and I think rightly says, that this has to go through a gauntlet, these rules, and that's why they're not releasing them. So I guess they think they want to win the propaganda war, that they're protecting the internet before they roll this out by stealth. But that isn't working for Obamacare, because as they roll it out, it becomes more unpopular by the day. So why are they engaging in this tactic?
Well, they may be trying to bolster their defenses against what's sure to be a legal attack on the net neutrality rules. The Court of Appeals here, and the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, has rebuked the FCC on numerous occasions for overreach. And they may be worried that the shallowness of their explanations need buttressing before there is going to be an immediate appeal. And perhaps and my expectation, Alex, would be that there'll be a stay of the FCC rules until there's a final court adjudication, which means there's years away, given the legal frailty of their promulgation.
What do you think is going to happen in your gut? I mean, the sense of Congress, the sense of the country, the sense of the other administrators and lawyers you talk to. Which way is this country going? Because it seems to be stampeding into an accelerated decline of the Roman Empire meets Buck Rogers. In your gut, where do you think this country and the world's going, Bruce Fein?
What we need is to restore our fundamental precepts as a country, which haven't changed in over 200 years. Human nature hasn't changed. No, the empire psychology hasn't changed. And we have, I think, Alex, anywhere from 30, maybe 35 years to completely reorient ourselves as a country whose influence abroad is the influence of example. We need to restore separation of powers back home, transparency. We defend ourselves, but we don't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, borrow $18, $19, $20 trillion running around the world like Don Quixote, thinking that we can change cultures that are 1,000, 5,000 years old if ethnic rivalries and despotism into democracies. You can't do it. You know, if you could, you know, those people who believe that, Alex, I say, let them hire me build a perpetual motion machine.
Sure.
It's truly stunning. Failure after failure. Afghanistan fails. Yemen fails. Iraq fails. Syria fails. Nowhere. Libya fails. All of that. They keep coming back and doing the same thing. I mean, after Libya is a perfect example. You got 126 militias. The whole thing is a Somalia-like desert land. And now we're going to visit the, you know. And remember, Libya and Yemen were viewed as the model that Obama singled out for pursuing ISIS. I mean, my God, the model? That's like saying, you know, General Custer's battle of the Little Bighorn is the model by which we'll fight the future Indian Wars. And you say, my God, are you crazy? And we need to just totally repudiate this idea that we have some kind of obligation and expertise to cure all the ills in the world. Nice if it was possible, we will destroy ourselves as a consequence.
Well, I think
my view is, Rand, if we can get Rand Paul and that philosophy back into the trajectory of where we're going as a country, we can save ourselves. Otherwise, we're following the path of the Roman Empire. It'll be just a matter of time. We'll bankrupt ourselves. We'll so overextend ourselves. We'll ultimately collapse.
Well, I agree with you. And in closing, you notice that Rand Paul won the CPAC poll, and he's nowhere in the news. And then they have a whisper campaign, libertarian movement. Oh, he's not perfect. You know, he's not his dad, so we better not support him. He's the best in the field. That's why the power structure's coming after him and ignoring him, folks. I want you to briefly comment on that because you got to go. And then also, have you heard about the London Guardian? Our reporters have been up there. There's a giant five-story and then a four-story and a three-story complex with black sites where people died, where people are kept for up to 2 days shackled and aren't even put in the arrest database in Chicago to then ring these fake confessions. They send police lieutenants and others from there to then run operations at torture camps at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Have you heard about this black site?
No, there have been cases in the past. Yuri, I think, was one where people just disappeared into the jaws of the CIA and were kidnapped and held for years illegally, but I have not fully apprised of what you've described there. I don't want to miss the opportunity to explain Rand Paul. Sure, he clearly is going to be the one most attacked because he's challenging the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about 50-some years ago. So they'll be making up all sorts of things about Rand and trying to obscure his popularity. And we need to remember, too, we're never going to get a candidate that is 100% everything we agree on. You know, no one's a clone of anybody else. He runs for office, and there are different demands than being a philosopher and writing something perfect. And we shouldn't squander, you know, the good on the altar of the perfect. So this is ridiculous to suggest that Rand doesn't deserve our support, you know, because there's a few semicolons and curly Qs that we disagree with. On the fundamental issues of who we are as a nation and of liberty being the center of our constitutional universe, he's heads and shoulders above any other candidate in the last 20 years.
Sure, nobody else is saying end all the foreign aid. Nobody else is saying massively slash taxes. Nobody else is doing what he's doing. I mean, Ted Cruz is a moderate second, but I don't know Ted Cruz. I know him. We've interviewed him, but I don't know him like I've known Rand for 20 years. I know you've known the Pauls longer than that. He's the real deal. That's why they're coming after him. We need to support him. Bruce Fine, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Okay.
That is a champion of the First Amendment right there and a guy of action. Bruce Fine, very honored to have him on with us, brucefinelaw.com. And finally tonight, I want to thank all of you for spending part of your Sunday with us and for spreading the word about the fight for human liberty, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. Lord willing, I'll be back tomorrow in studio live, 11 a.m. Central, 12 noon Eastern, for the three-hour InfoWars.com worldwide transmission. Until then, never forget, if you're listening or watching this transmission, you are the resistance.